Always look on the right side of life.
WRT Madison.
For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the
The time is now 6 o'clock. Welcome to WORT's local news for Tuesday, April 1st. I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful.
And I'm your host, Jess Miller. In tonight's news, the Realtors Association is once again flooding their preferred city council candidates with cash.
Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan describes the work ahead.
And in the second half, the Milkweed investigates some so-called mozzarella sticks. Wirt gets a federal funding update from Wisconsin's DATCAP secretary. And Wildlife Weekly successfully reunites a little owlet with its parents.
All these stories and more on tonight's news, but first we go live to the BBC for reports from around the world.
I'm Govinda Gill with the BBC News. The White House says President Trump is putting the final touches to his plan for sweeping new tariffs that it's feared could trigger a global trade war. The announcement is expected on Wednesday evening and could affect trillions of dollars of US imports. Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney insisted his country would not allow its workers to be disadvantaged.
As I made clear to President Trump in our call last week, I will reject all attempts to weaken Canada, all attempts to wear us down, to break us down, so that America can own us. That will never, ever happen.
Days after the Sudanese army retook Khartoum from its paramilitary rivals, the BBC has witnessed the widespread destruction that has been inflicted across the capital. A local rights group says some Sudanese army troops summarily executed prisoners in Khartoum. The BBC's Barbara Plett-Usher has been to the capital and says concerns about the future are rife.
There was the revolution, the pro-democracy revolution in 2019, that led to the toppling of the military leader Omar al-Bashir. And then there were civilians working together with military leaders. By the way, the military leaders, which then turned on each other and started a civil war. But there was a progression towards trying to get at least some sort of civilian government back in power. Now, I have to say, the society has become really militarized. The soldiers are heroes. Little boys are taking pictures holding guns. What are the chances of returning a civilian government in the way that they were trying to do before? That is a real question.
The U.S. immigration authorities have admitted making a mistake when they deported a Salvadorian man to a jail in his country. Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia was among more than 200 suspected gang members who were deported to El Salvador in March. Our Central America correspondent Will Grant has more details.
Mr. Abrego Garcia's lawyers have said he received protected legal status from an immigration judge after originally being slated for deportation in 2019. His legal team have urged the US government to ensure his immediate return to the United States from the mega prison, calling it a notorious detention chamber. In a post on X, Vice President J.D. Vance called Mr. Abrego Garcia a convicted MS-13 gang member. Mr. Abrego Garcia's legal team firmly denies the claim, stating that he has no criminal convictions either in the US or El Salvador.
Venezuela says it will send a plane to Mexico on Thursday to pick up 300 migrants who have recently fled to the United States. According to President Nicolas Maduro, most of them are women and children who crossed into Mexico for fear of persecution by the US authorities. BBC News. The authorities in Haiti say fighting is continuing in the city of Mirbalay a day after a criminal gang stormed the local prison and released more than 500 inmates. Thousands of residents have fled to neighbouring areas as rival gangs fight for control of the city. Haitian media reported that groups of armed residents have been patrolling the streets. Sales of Elon Musk's Tesla electric vehicles have continued to plunge in much of Europe. Analysts have blamed competition from Chinese competitors combined with opposition to Mr. Musk's backing of far-right groups in Europe. In France, Tesla sales fell by nearly 37% last month compared with a year ago. The figure in Sweden was more than 63% down. The authorities in Syria say the entire country has lost power due to several malfunctions on the national electricity grid. Technical teams are reported to be working to resolve the problem. Syria is already affected by severe energy shortages, as many power plants sustained severe damage during 14 years of conflict. Most areas only get 2 or 3 hours supply per day. A Democratic Party senator is nearing the record for the longest speech on the floor of the US Senate. Cory Booker has been delivering a fierce denunciation of Donald Trump's presidency for 24 hours. He occasionally sounded tearful as he lambasted Mr. Trump's first few months in office. Among his many criticisms was the president's description of US tariffs as liberating the American people.
I just feel that Trump mocks us. What does his Liberation Day mean to the people that are shackled to debt, from medical debt, that are shackled with student debt, that can't afford the rising cost of groceries? What's his liberation mean?
This is Jess Miller and Sarah Hopeful with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison.
Tech billionaire Elon Musk gave out $1 million checks on Sunday to two randomly selected Wisconsin voters, their prize for signing an online petition against so-called activist judges. The giveaway was yet another maneuver in Musk's push to elect conservative candidate Brad Schimmel to the Wisconsin Supreme Court in today's election. When the two recipients accepted the $1 million checks at the Green Bay event on Sunday, their identities went public. The first winner has no discernible ties to politics, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, but the second winner, Nicholas Jacobs, has some speculating on social media that the giveaway wasn't so random. Jacobs, a student at UW-River Falls, is the chairman of Wisconsin's College Republicans chapter. He's also worked for Senator Ron Johnson and Representative Derek Van Orden in past campaigns, according to his LinkedIn profile. And most recently this fall, Jacobs worked for Turning Point Action, a conservative group focused on youth voter outreach. Jacobs briefly made his account private on X following the social media backlash, but it appears to be public once again. His latest post around 3 this afternoon thanks Musk for the, quote, incredible opportunity, unquote, and urges his followers to go out and vote for Brad Schimmel.
Democrats in the U.S. Senate introduced a bill yesterday that would order the Agriculture Department to resume frozen payments to farmers across the country, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. Wisconsin's Democratic Senator Tammy Baldwin is one of 17 co-sponsors on the bill, 15 Democrats and 2 independents. Countless farmers and farm organizations are waiting on reimbursements from the USDA, reimbursements that are stalled under orders from the Trump administration. Senator Baldwin has accused President Trump of cheating American farmers, adding that the frozen payments are threatening small businesses and livelihoods across the country. The Honor Farmer Contracts Act would require the USDA to fulfill its signed contracts and release the funding. It would also require the agency to restore past due payments as soon as possible and bar the USDA from canceling contracts in the future unless the farmer fails to comply with the terms and conditions. Finally, the bill would prohibit the USDA from closing field offices without notifying Congress at least 60 days before the closure.
Madison leaders raised the transgender pride flag over the city municipal building yesterday in recognition of Transgender Day of Visibility. Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway said the flag is a symbol of the city's respect for individual rights and a rejection of hate. And Alder Dina Nina Martinez Rutherford, the first transgender member of the city council, described it as, quote, a beacon of hope, a reminder that we will not be erased, unquote. Meanwhile, state Democrats introduced a slate of bills seeking to protect transgender Wisconsinites, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. One would prohibit discrimination on the basis of gender identity, One would loosen requirements for those seeking to change their name if they're doing so for gender identity reasons. And the third would declare Transgender Day of Visibility a statewide holiday. The package follows last month's flurry of activity from state Republicans, who joined forces last month to advance a handful of bills focused on transgender kids. The bills sought to divide sports teams by assigned gender at birth, prohibit gender-affirming medical care for minors, and limit their ability to change their names and pronouns at school. Governor Tony Evers has vetoed similar legislation in the past and is about to do so again if necessary.
It's business as usual at the state Capitol building after Capitol Police debunked a bomb threat yesterday, reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The culprit? Parts of a children's toy. According to a statement from the Department of Administration, a person entered the building just after noon yesterday and told an officer they had a bomb. The threat was found not credible after observing that the person actually had Nerf darts taped to their belt. The person was detained and removed from the building, and the K-9 team discovered no signs of explosives. Officers determined the person was suffering from a mental health crisis and decided not to evacuate the Capitol building. They took the person to the Dane County Jail.
A student injured in the December shooting at Abundant Life Christian School is back in critical condition, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Six people were injured in the attack. Four of them were soon released from the hospital after receiving treatment. Two victims were listed under critical condition and, after a long recovery, were upgraded to good condition in mid-January. One was discharged at the end of January and returned to school soon after. But Sammy, the sixth victim, stayed on in the hospital. He's recently returned to critical condition again, according to a UW Health spokesperson. In a Facebook post on Friday, Sammy's pastor at Lighthouse Church wrote that Sammy is unresponsive. The church is planning a prayer vigil for Sammy tomorrow at 7 p.m. The student was one of six injured in the attack and one of two listed in critical condition until mid-January.
And it's Election Day. There's still time to vote, and there's a lot on your ballot. Voters across the state will select a new Supreme Court justice and the next head of the Department of Public Instruction, and they'll decide whether Wisconsin's voting ID requirements should be codified in the state's constitution. Other local races will be on your ballot. In Dane County, Melissa Agard is again on the ballot. She was elected last fall to fill the remainder of Joe Parisi's term as county executive. She faces competitor Steven Ratzlaff for a regular four-seat term as county executive. And here in Madison, 14 city council races are competitive. Some of those seats will be for a one-year rather than a regular two-year term. That's because the city is switching to staggered alder elections. Instead of every 2 years, you'll now see some alder seats on the ballot every spring. You can find Wart's interviews with the candidates online at wartfm.org/candidates. One Madison race for school board is also on the ballot. As of 4 p.m., more than 96,000 ballots have been cast across the city. As of last Friday, more than 500,000 voters in Wisconsin had already voted. If you haven't yet, though, polls are open until 8 p.m. tonight. You can see what's on your ballot at myvote.wi.gov, as well as find what type of identification will be required at your voting location. If you still haven't registered, you can do so at your polling location. Just make sure you also bring a proof of address. Those were tonight's headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Nearly three-quarters of this spring's city council races are competitive, and while some races are flushed with cash, others are flying under the radar. The biggest spender this spring? A political action committee funded by the Realtors Association of South Central Wisconsin. WORT news producer Faye Parks has the details.
14 Madison City Council races are competitive, and those campaigns have brought in almost $149,000 in donations since the start of this year, according to finance reports submitted ahead of today's election. This total excludes District 2 candidate Matt Egger, District 5 candidate Ulrika Dieterle, District 13 candidate Robert Luther, District 18 candidate Kevin Monroe, and District 20 candidate Sammy Kilgee. As of this report, their filings were not available on the city clerk's website. The most expensive city race this spring is between incumbent alder Mike Revere and his challenger, Eli Sarofsky. They're running to represent downtown Madison and combined have received nearly $21,400 since January 1st, and they've spent just over $17,500. The next most expensive race is between incumbent alder Nikki Conklin and her challenger, Dr. Joanne Perchette. They're running to represent Madison's far west side and combined have received more than $19,000 since January 1st. They've spent just over $16,400. The cheapest race this spring clocks in at just $1,000 raised since January 1st and just $200 spent. That's how much incumbent Westside Alder Tag Evers has spent to defend his seat against challenger Robert Luther. Luther's campaign finance reports are not available on the city clerk's website. Spending is also relatively low in the race between incumbent Westside Alder Regina Vitiver and her challenger Ulrika Dieterle. Dieterle's campaign finance reports are not available on the city clerk's website. While Alder Vitiver has raised just over $3,100 and spent $860 to defend her seat. The majority of direct candidate contributions this spring came from private citizens, but some local organizations cropped up frequently in the candidates' filings. AFSCME Wisconsin Council 32, Madison Professional Police Officers Association, and the Realtors Association of South Central Wisconsin. Under state law, political action committees can directly contribute up to $400 per candidate per election cycle. But there is a loophole, one that the Realtors Association is using to flood their preferred candidates with cash. PACs can spend unlimited funds on mailers and online advertising if they do so without coordinating with the candidates. That lack of coordination means that candidates' campaign finance reports don't tell the full story. The Housing Advocacy Fund, a political action committee funded by the Realtors Association of South Central Wisconsin, has independently invested nearly $92,000 this spring in six of their preferred candidates. The group has spent almost $13,600 in support of Wilahovich, a self-described Yes in My Backyard or YIMBY candidate who's vying for an open seat in downtown Madison. They spent just under $14,000 supporting incumbent downtown Alder Mike Revere, who served on the city council since 1995 and recently appeared alongside a panda in a series of comical ads on social media. They spent just over $13,600 backing incumbent Westside Alder Regina Vitiver, who's repeatedly supported changes to the city's zoning code that seek to promote more efficient housing development. They spent just over $13,500 supporting incumbent Alder Nikki Conklin. Her opponent, Dr. Joanne Perchette, has questioned the Realtors Association, namely, their motives in supporting housing density efforts in the city. They spent almost $13,300 backing incumbent Alder and current council president Janet Figueroa-Cole, who faces a challenger in former city staffer Lisa Veldren. And the group's biggest investment this spring was in support of incumbent Westside Alder John Huguer at just over $15,300. Alder Huguer faces challenger Nino Amato, a harsh critic of Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway, who last served on the city council in the 70s. The group's spending this spring is a significant drop compared to 2 years ago, when they invested nearly $170,000 to independently back nine of their preferred city council candidates. Three recipients in 2023 are back on the Realtors Association's list this year, though for slightly more modest sums. In 2023, the group invested $20,000 to back Alder Mike Revere's campaign, $9,000 to back Alder Nikki Conklin, and $20,000 to back Alder John Huguer, though they spelled his name incorrectly on the mailer. That investment made headlines, and the candidates collectively condemned the Housing Advocacy Fund's financial meddling, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. The recipients in 2023 signed a joint letter writing that the independent backing came as a surprise, and quote, "We strongly oppose these types of expenditures in Madison's local political campaigns," unquote. The next deadline for candidates to file campaign finance reports is in July. For WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
It's now 6:19 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
In recognition of Transgender Day of Visibility yesterday, Madison leaders raised the Transgender Pride flag outside the city municipal building. And state Democrats introduced legislation that would codify protections for transgender Wisconsinites. Their actions are a microcosm of a larger fight happening on the national stage. Sitting down this morning with WORT's Vicki Kenyon, Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan described the work ahead and explained why he's backing the Transgender Healthcare Access Act.
Yeah, I mean, in general right now, you know, Congress and unfortunately many state legislatures with a Republican majority are, you know, incredibly unsupportive of the trans community in many cases, you know, really victimizing them and demonizing them in ways that are done for political purposes. And it's really unconscionable. So what we were trying to do is put something positive forward, something that would, you know, let people realize that there are people who care. There are people who want to make sure we're supportive. And despite the fact that in this Congress, nothing good will happen, we can still advocate for policies that are inclusive and supportive and to show that, you know, it's not America that doesn't care. It's really, unfortunately, some politicians.
Talk to me about your thoughts on marriage equality. Where do you think we're headed with that?
Well, you know, I think we're waiting to see what else the Trump administration may do. You know, Project 2025 appears to be the blueprint for what they're doing. They've started with going after federal employees. Just about everything that's been in Project 2025 in that area is happening. Fortunately, much of what they're doing is illegal. And I think now we've had over 50 court adjudications ruled in our favor. So the good news is the legal system works. Even Trump-appointed judges are ruling against the illegality that is in Project 2025. But I do think we have to look at however Project 2025 addresses the LGBTQI plus community, we have to assume there could be some issues trying to, you know, moving through Congress and through this executive branch that relate to those goals in Project 2025.
Yeah, I mean, they laid it out ahead of the election and it's happening.
Yeah, you know, I did 6 town halls around the state trying to make people aware. And I think, you know, even I'm surprised at how fast they've taken to it and started moving things forward. So, you know, the good news is we largely have a plan other than Social Security. They were silent on that purposely. And
yeah,
see some, and I think some foreshadowing of attacks. But everything else so far is largely out of Project 2025.
So you mentioned town halls. Can you talk about your absent GOP town halls? It's brilliant.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, common sense says if you're proud of something you're doing, you'd want to get on the rooftop and shout about it. They're all hiding in their basements and not doing town halls. So, you know, I've been one of the kind of the first folks here, I guess, doing this. And now we've got 20 or 30 of us, you know, going into Republican districts and doing town halls. You know, our job is really at its core taking the views of our district to Washington and explaining Washington back home. And if you don't do town halls, you're not doing the most fundamental basics of your job. So, you know, I've gone to places like Viroqua in Derek Van Orden's district, and it's, you know, community of 4,500 people, 300 to 400 people show up, right? And
right,
we ask them, are you a George Soros funded person? Because that's kind of the lame line that comes from some Republicans. And of course, no one is. These are community people who are concerned about cuts to Medicaid, which is healthcare and long-term care, cuts to education, cuts to food assistance, cuts to programs that benefit the middle class and those aspiring to be in the middle class, all so that they can get $4.5 trillion for a tax break for Elon Musk and Donald Trump. So I think these times are anything but normal. Doing things maybe a little bit not normal are good. And if I have to do town halls in a neighboring district in addition to mine, you know, I'm fine with doing that. And I think more and more members are doing the same thing.
Yeah, it does seem to be catching on. I was the first one you did, I think, was in Belmont, Wisconsin, and the attendance number was crazy. There was almost 1,000 people there.
Yeah. Now that one is interesting because we did it at the edge of my district, but there were 10,000 people 7 minutes away in Derek Van Orden's district. Mine, there's only 1,000 people in all of Belmont, you know, in the community that we did it at. So I think, you know, doing this type of either at the edge of a district or in another district to raise awareness is really key. And the media has been showing up. And rightfully so, people have been showing up. I mean, they want to be heard. We've had record levels of calls and emails to the office, and I've been in office over 12 years at the federal level. People are rightfully so concerned, some cases frightened, emotions. So I think, you know, we're doing what we can to be helpful.
So, Mark, I know you're pressed for time this morning, as usual. That's good. That means you're busy. Is there anything specific you want to say that I might not be asking you about?
No, I just think people should realize in the month of April, it is likely they could vote on the cuts to Medicaid, to food assistance, to subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, to education funding, because that's been the goal. Donald Trump wanted to do it in his first 100 days, and we're reaching the end of that 100 days. So now is the time to be active and to reach out to your elected officials, because if we put pressure on our elected officials to actually listen to us, you won't cut things that people benefit from. 1.3 million people in Wisconsin receive help from Medicaid. One out of three kids gets their health insurance from Medicaid in Wisconsin. 55% of seniors in nursing homes, including my mom, get their help before she passed from Medicaid when they're in a nursing home. So these are real things that really affect people, and we need to speak out. We need to know that politics is not a spectator sport, and calling your representative in Congress as well as your two senators is really key more than ever.
Lots of us think the presidential election is the most important election, and while it is important, because of the way things have played out, local elections, school boards, judges are becoming more and more important, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in places like Madison, you can be laboratories for good public policy because you have good elected officials. And even in the state of Wisconsin, we have a good governor who can do things where the legislature maybe can't intervene that can help people when we've got a federal government right now that's hurting people. So it really does matter. If people have ever thought politics doesn't matter to them, hopefully this is a wake-up period to realize why it does matter. We're watching these attacks, especially on the trans community right now, that are just vulgar, really, is the only way to describe them. You know, the Republican governor of Utah vetoed a bill that their legislature passed that was going to ban trans girls from participating in sports. And his reasoning, I thought, you know, was just so honest, and I wish more Republicans could be honest. Out of 75,000 kids in the K-12 system in Utah that are in organized sports, three were trans and one was a trans girl. But he also mentioned that the suicidality rate for many LGBTQ teens, especially trans teens, is up as high as 80%. People think about it because of adults bullying them. So when the Marjorie Taylor Greens and the Nancy Maces and I guess formerly the Matt Gaetzes and other people who aren't the sharpest crayons in the box come up with these ideas in order to appeal to their base, they actually hurt real people. And we need more governors and state legislatures and local elected officials to recognize that. Fortunately, in Wisconsin, we have a good governor and we have places like Madison that can do good things. But those elections mean all the more because of it.
So, Mark, give us a final message. What can we do to make an impact?
Yeah, so I think at the federal level in particular, it's litigation and communication. So support the groups doing the litigation. If you Google Trump litigation tracker, there's several that will show you all the lawsuits that are out there and find the groups that are fighting for what you care about. And then communication, you know, fight against this disinformation. Share information from myself and Tammy Baldwin and others who you like what they have to say, because we can put the real facts out there about what's going on, that they are trying to cut Medicaid, that they are going after Social Security, the things that people really count on. And I think by doing that, we'll wake people up to what's actually happening. We're all in this together. Some of us are fortunate to have a seat at the table, but honestly, without the grassroots activism, we're not so powerful in getting things done. And it's a continuous operation inside and outside of places like the U.S. Capitol that we win on.
That was a short excerpt of Vicky Kenyon's full interview with U.S. Representative Mark Pocan. You can listen to their full conversation on Query tomorrow night at 7 p.m.
You're listening to local news by local people here on WORT.
Stay with us. We've got a lot more stories for you coming up in the second half of the show. The Milkweed investigates some so-called mozzarella sticks.
Wart gets a federal funding update from Wisconsin's DATCAP secretary.
And Wildlife Weekly successfully reunites a little owlet with its parents.
But now we'll take a quick break and check in on some world headlines back in a flash.
Do you have an insatiable curiosity about the world? Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. And of course, we'll need you to be here every Tuesday from 12 to 1 p.m. Apply by May 2nd. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
BBC News with Govinda Gill. The White House says President Trump is finalizing his plans for sweeping new tariffs. He's due to announce the measures on Wednesday evening in what his administration is calling Liberation Day. There's still no confirmation of how many countries will be affected. A BBC team has witnessed devastation across Sudan's capital, Khartoum, days after the army retook the city. Government ministries and tower blocks are in ruins. Residents have expressed relief that the rapid support forces are no longer in charge. The US immigration authorities have admitted making a mistake when they deported a Salvadorian man to a jail in his home country. Quilma Abrego Garcia was among 240 people accused of being gang members. A French appeals court has said it will review the far-right leader Marine Le Pen's conviction for embezzlement. If the ruling's overturned, she could be eligible to run for the 2027 presidential election. Guinea's military government says it will hold a referendum in September on a new constitution. The vote is intended to pave the way for elections. The junta failed to keep a promise to return to civilian rule by the end of last year. Turkey's main opposition party has joined calls by student groups for economic boycotts to protest against the detention of Istanbul's mayor. There have been mass demonstrations since Ekrem İmamoğlu's arrest last month. In the past few minutes, a Democratic Party senator has broken the record for the longest speech in the US Senate. Cory Booker has been delivering a fierce condemnation of Donald Trump's presidency for more than 24 hours. Syria suffered a nationwide blackout. Officials say teams are working to fix the problem, which has been caused by malfunctions on the electricity grid. BBC News.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm Sarah Hopeful, here with Jess Miller. Thanks for joining us.
Once in a blue moon, McDonald's brings back a seasonal item with a long history, so-called mozzarella sticks. The mega chain first put the item on their menu 10 years ago, but a Madison-based lab discovered extra ingredients in the cheese. Following a class action lawsuit, McDonald's pulled the sticks from their menu. The milkweed played a starring role in this story. Pete Harden gave host Bert Zipperer the rundown.
Welcome to the Milkweed on WORT. I'm Bert Zipperer, and we're talking with Pete Harden, who for 46 years has been publisher and editor of the monthly newspaper, The Milkweed, dairy farming's best information and insights, with their motto, float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. And today's topic is McDonald's mozzarella sticks 2.0. Take it away, Pete. Hi.
Thank you, Bert. McDonald's, that small fast food chain, operates in a few regions of the country.
I think I've heard of it.
Or the world. McDonald's has announced that it is going to revive a product called mozzarella sticks, which 10 years ago suffered a rather unfortunate fate, in great part at the hands of the milkweed.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, originally in late summer, early fall 2015, when McDonald's announced that it would be rolling out nationally mozzarella sticks as an entree or hors d'oeuvre or whatever they wanted to call it. That was exciting news because here in the upper Midwest, we're quite familiar with restaurants offering mozzarella sticks as an appetizer, whatever. So, boy, if a national food chain could take these products nationwide, we hope it would sell more cheese and benefit dairy farmers through selling more cheese and higher milk prices, et cetera, et cetera. And then the problem started. When these products were available locally here in the Madison area, I bought some and ran them through my taste testing panel down at the print shop in Broadhead. If we were going to give those products a collective grade, it would have been D minus at best.
Why was that?
Well, several reasons. They were breaded mozzarella sticks, and the breading compromised almost half of the product weight. And then secondly, the cheese portion not only didn't taste right, it didn't look right. And that raised my suspicions because, let's put it this way, there's a lot of money in processed foods by simply adding plant-based starch and water. Plant-based starches in processed foods will retain 10 times their own weight in water. So if you have 100 pounds of processed materials that look like cheese,
a
food processor, and they add 1 pound of starch, then they may add an additional 10 pounds of water. So they end up with 111 pounds of material. And those last two inputs are rather cheaply priced.
So starch carries 10 times its weight in water in that sort of food. Talk more about these mozzarella sticks. You did some testing.
Yeah. Based on my historic suspicions, I suspected starch was present. So I consulted one of my friends who is a food scientist here in the Madison area. And he said, let me help out, because he knew that if iodine is put onto cheese that contains starch, there will be a bubbling effect.
Really?
So
okay.
He went to McDonald's, bought some stuff, went to the pharmacy, bought some iodine, put the iodine on the cheese portion of the breaded cheese sticks, and said he'd never seen such bubbling in his life. So that was my cue to take samples to what was then Covance Labs on the east side of Madison, and paid Covance several hundred bucks to test the core cheese for starch presence. And their test came back showing that it was almost 4% starch. Product could have been up to 40% water. Now, McDonald's called these things mozzarella sticks, but mozzarella is a protected term by the Food and Drug Administration, a standardized term. And for standardized cheese products or dairy products, only a list of allowed ingredients by the FDA are approved. Water and plant starch are not approved for mozzarella.
So the FDA has these standards of identity.
Yes.
That clearly specifically notes what can be in that product.
And anything else, any other ingredients would cause such products to be adulterated and misbranded, i.e. illegal.
And you mentioned that starch is a miraculous money-making filler.
Yes. I urge readers to look at some of the processed food products at the store next time they're shopping and check out some of the processed national brands of processed dairy products for water and starch.
So what's happening with these mozzarella sticks now?
Well, let's give a little history. I got the test back from Covance. Now doing business as LabCorp here in Madison. The December 2015 issue, The Milkweed, page one, top story.
It's a great story.
McDonald's mozzarella, breaded mozzarella sticks, adulterated and misbranded. I had a New York City law firm all queued up to sue McDonald's on a class action basis for false advertising, which they did using my lab result. The lawsuit went forward. And meanwhile, on the social media, there were many, many comments from consumers about what a crappy product these mozzarella sticks were for reasons they didn't even fully understand. So long story short, the lawsuit proceeded. Because my product samples were the basis of the lawsuit, I went to Covance about a month and a half after the lawsuit was filed to request that they charge me a monthly fee to retain the samples, because if the samples got thrown out, then the lawsuit was endangered. Covance got back to me and told me the following: get the H out of here, get your blankety blank samples out of here, and never come back. You have created a huge problem for one of our biggest customers, presumably McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
And I have subsequently learned through my son's contacts with folks who formerly worked at now LabCorp, then Covance, that McDonald's was one of their biggest customers. And I never mentioned Covance in the story. That was part of the deal. No mention of the lab. But I guess McDonald's figured out who I used.
So are they coming out with these sticks again?
Yes. McDonald's has announced a version 2.0 of breaded mozzarella sticks. I await the arrival of these products. we'll do our taste tests and get out my little bottle of iodine. but the bottom line is there are standards of identity for dairy products. You call something cheddar, it has to conform with the only containing the ingredients for cheddar. Same for, you know, butter.
Exactly.
Yogurt. These are standards of identity.
To protect consumers. So when you buy it, you know you're getting it.
And over time, I have just repeatedly in the milkweed, as part of our investigative journalism efforts, exposed products illegally appropriating dairy products, names that have federal standards. And it's very frustrating, A, to see the abuse of these things by marketers, but also failure by government agents such as FDA or even the State Department of Agriculture to enforce the laws.
And that's it for this week of Milkweed on WORT. We want to note that this is not an April Fool's joke. This is actually a true story.
You got it.
Pete, it's good to have you. We'll be back next week with Pete Hardin here on WORT. Thank you.
It's now 6:41 p.m. and you're bathing in the live local news on WORT.
In the first couple of months of his second term, President Donald Trump has thrown the nation into chaos with unilateral and perhaps illegal cuts to funding already allocated by Congress. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has been in Trump's crosshairs with the cancellation of $500 million in aid to food pantries, over $1 billion in food aid to local schools, and cuts to already awarded producer grants. Throw on top of that the Trump administration's threats of tariffs, and you have a recipe for severe strains on farmers. Here in Wisconsin, one of the nation's leading agricultural states, farmers and policymakers fear economic disaster. Randy Romanski is the secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection. Sitting down with WRT's Brian Standing, he shared the latest updates on the federal funding cuts.
The producer grants that were previously allocated by Congress, and then the Trump administration announced that they were going to claw those back. And then there were threats of lawsuits. And then at some point, the Trump administration says, no, it's okay, we're going to put them back. But what's happened now? Are those still on the table? Are the ones that are already allocated still being paid out to producers, or are those still up in the air?
It's a mixed bag right now, Brian. There are some instances, and I'll use an example, the Dairy Business Innovation Initiatives. Wisconsin is one of the four hubs for that program, federally funded program, previously approved, got congressional stamp of approval. That was initially under review and on hold. Governor Evers, Wisconsin as a state, our other partner states that are part of this group, the industry have all weighed in strongly saying, look, this is the great program. It's doing what was intended. Congress has authorized the program funding. Please release the funding. And the Dairy Business Innovation Initiative funding has been released. Some of the other holds or cancellation, it's unknown to have the impacts of some of those as of yet because they're still ongoing. It's a program called the Local Food Purchasing Agreement. That program has done a lot to connect those dots between new and beginning farmers or small farmers and a market that is meaningful. And we've been told here at the state level that the ongoing program for, you know, this year is allowed, but there was funding that was approved for fiscal year 25. We had signed contracts saying, yes, this funding will be available, and now that's been rescinded, unfortunately.
You mentioned signed contracts and the funding's already allocated. Is the state of Wisconsin prepared to sue if those funds are not restored?
One of the things that we're trying to do is work through the process. So Governor Evers has urged the Trump administration to restore the funding for LFPA 2025. We continue to ask questions about that program. It is terminating that contract, that LFPA 2025 contract, is a departure of the federal administration's pledge to support farmers. So we are continuing to review what our options are.
Have you heard any response from USDA?
Well, the last response we got was a termination of the LFPA 25 program.
One of the things I know DATCAP does is they help administer millions of dollars of conservation funds that go directly to farmers to implement soil and water conservation practices. There's a lot of state and federal funding going into that. Have you heard anything about how safe that funding stream is?
The land and water conservation programs have been wildly popular in the state of Wisconsin. And I'm going to say farmers and organizations have really kind of taken a lead on being very proactive with soil and water conservation programs. A good portion of that is a direct thank you to Governor Evers and the legislature for finding bipartisan agreement on things like a program called the Nitrogen Optimization Program or the Produced-Led Watershed Grant Program that gives farmers tools to do more to help conserve their land and their water. Federal government plays a role in that too. As far as the funding goes, Brian, I keep in touch regularly with our finance team because things are fluid. At this point, I haven't seen an impact to the funding that might be available for some of those conservation programs, but we have to keep an eye on it because we find that programs come under that review period and that can happen quickly. So we need to be aware of that. I do have to express some concerns about the reductions to staff at the federal level. We need partners to work with farmers on their land and water conservation efforts. And I have to say that having NRCS engaged with our agency, with the local governments, with farmers, has been a big plus in recent years in trying to implement some of those practices that are good practices, best practices for soil and water conservation. It's concerning if some of those folks are no longer around to be that resource, to be that boots on the ground or best practices sounding board.
I want to shift gears a little bit. You talked about developing international markets, and one of the other things we've been hearing out of the Trump administration is tariffs on Canada, products from Canada, products from Mexico, possibly maybe even the EU. How important is that international market to Wisconsin agriculture, and are you worried about tariffs both from in anything that producers and the industry needs to import, you know, certain specialty crops or things like that that might be imported from other places. But perhaps more significantly, are you worried about the impacts of retaliatory tariffs on American and Wisconsin agricultural goods?
How important are international markets to Wisconsin? Very, very important. Wisconsin competes at a high level in the international marketplace because of the quality and diversity of products that we have. You know, I can go down the list, and I won't because it's a long list, but I'll mention a couple of them. We're known as America's Dairyland for a good reason. 90% of our milk goes into cheese. 90% of that cheese leaves our state. And so that's a big deal. We produce 25% of our nation's cheese, 50% of our nation's specialty cheese. And a lot of that cheese goes outside of the state of Wisconsin. So that's very important. We produce 60% of the nation's cranberries here in the state of Wisconsin. We produce about 90 to 95% of the ginseng that's grown in the United States, and much of that is exported. So it's a really diverse portfolio, and there's obviously much more, but I'm just kind of scratching the surface. And the important thing to mention is that Wisconsin farmers and processors compete on quality. So it's my belief that a fair, free, and open market is the best way that we can allow Wisconsin products to continue to compete in the marketplace. There's a lot of factors that are involved with international trade, but the last 4 years are the highest years for export of food, forestry, and agriculture products since the state's been keeping track of it. So what I would say, again, I go back to quality products, very diverse group of products, but also the state has identified international markets as very important, and the state has invested funding to help grow that export base. And so last year, 2024, we just got the numbers in the second highest level of food, forestry, and agriculture exports on record. So Wisconsin is trending in a good direction, and our state motto is forward, so I like to point that out. We can't afford to go backward because of artificial trade barriers that get put in the way of moving Wisconsin products around the world.
That was Randy Romanski, the Secretary of the State's Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Visit WRTFM.org to hear the rest of his conversation with Brian Standing, Monday host of the 8 o'clock Buzz.
Baby season is just beginning here in South Central Wisconsin, and birds are especially at risk of injury or early separation from their parents. Featured contributor Jackie Sandberg shares a successful reunion story in this edition of Wildlife Weekly.
Welcome to Wildlife Weekly. My name is Jackie Sandberg, and I'm the Wildlife Program Manager for the Dane County Humane Society here in Madison, Wisconsin. Each week, we choose a topic related to wildlife rehabilitation or the environment, and today I'm excited to tell you about my adventure recently of a little great horned owl hatchling reunite that was so successful, but it was also really, really scary. So it is the time of year where baby owls are being found on the ground because their nests are either maybe disrupted by the wind and the storms that we've had, or it occasionally is because an old nest has been so dilapidated that there are holes the babies can fall through and they're not well built, mostly because great horned owls don't make their own nests. They steal them from other species like red-tailed hawks or bald eagles or even squirrels, believe it or not. So this little friend, he was so cute, probably close to about 4 weeks old or so, had dropped from a tree in a neighborhood and had ended up on the road. Now, usually an owl is going to naturally fledge the nest after a good number of weeks. Usually, I think about 6 to 8 weeks is a good time for them to start really branching away from the outside of the nest. And then many weeks later, they eventually find their way to the ground and can find their way back up, believe it or not. They're actually really good about being able to run up trees with a little bit of speed. And you can actually see them grab on with their talons to the sides of the bark and then flap their wings really fast to get that momentum needed to just launch themselves up to a lower branch. And then they continue to branch, just how that sounds. They kind of take one step to the next and climb a tree back up to the nest site. So it's not uncommon for us to find great horned owl babies on the ground, but it is uncommon to find it in the early couple of weeks of life. So typically a new hatchling out of the egg or anything in that first like 4 to 6 weeks or so, when they're still nest bound, still fluffy, still full of down, and it's really white fluffy feathers that are kind of coating the entirety of the owl, I usually like to think if you can't see their little horns yet, they're probably too young to be out. And that's just anecdotal from my opinion, but they usually don't have those horn feathers fully formed, and so they still have a very round head, and they still have white grayish to brownish down. So this little guy was on the road, so, you know, falling from a really high tree, you could hit asphalt and concrete and hard surfaces that sometimes come along with injuries like a fractured foot or a leg or pelvis, sometimes even a fractured wing, or sometimes we see puncture wounds from the birds falling through the branches. Sometimes those branches are really sturdy and they poke through the skin, so you'll see lacerations or puncture wounds. So every case is really different, and in most situations, if they are too young to be truly out of the nest yet, we like to suggest they come in for an evaluation by a rehabilitator just to make sure that nothing is broken. So this little owlet had the full works, you know, he got a full exam by our licensed rehabilitation staff. We did blood work, we did ophthalmology, looking in the back of the eyes, we did x-rays, everything that we needed to for this little owl to make sure that he was healthy enough to be able to go back to the care of his parents. The fun thing is that, well, the nest that they chose, although it was sturdy, was right above a road. And so, as you would imagine, bird fell out once, so he's probably going to fall out again. The tree was also kind of an older tree. Even though the nest was good, the tree was going to have to probably come down just naturally from age. And it could have been part of the reason why the bird fell out in the first place. But it was suggested by our team of wonderful volunteer arborists that maybe adjusting the bird to a tree that was adjacent, pretty close, and putting a new nest basket up would actually be a better solution for this little owlet. So it was a nice big tree. It was actually a coniferous tree. It was a white pine. It was beautiful. And so we took our bushel basket filled with goodies inside. And by that, I mean like lots of nesting branches put together in a concentric kind of cup-shaped nest and ring so that they had their own beautiful sturdy nest that they'll hopefully use year after year now after this and put it up into that tree that was adjacent, but not quite above the road. So close, but I would say within about 50 feet, maybe a little longer. So that tree being really close by, you know, the parents watched the whole time. So we had our volunteers out there with the little owlet and our arborist climbing the trees, and they were in the neighborhood. You could see both mom and dad, and they were just monitoring and watching, and they were being really cute about it. And our volunteers said that it was actually quite successful, or so they thought, that, you know, the little owl was there, the parents were carefully watching from a distance, making sure their baby was safe, and we thought, okay, all is well and done, it's going to be just fine. So, you know, that was closer to a later afternoon reunite, and usually we stay to watch that evening to double check, you know, did mom and dad come to approach the baby, did they try feeding, and we didn't really see evidence of that right away, but we know that the parents were right in that area, so we decided to leave it, because he was about 4 weeks old, he could thermoregulate pretty naturally, meaning he could control his body temperature better than like a newborn hatchling. And so the next day we monitored again, and that's where we started to get a little bit worried. You know, our volunteers were like, well, you know, I saw mom and dad, but I really haven't seen him on the basket yet. And so, you know, I started to get nervous just as a rehabilitator myself, wondering, oh, you know, the temperatures are going to drop today and it's going to be a little cold and he's probably hungry and wondering where his parents are. And we spend a lot of time trying to reunite by playing calls of begging baby great horned owls. A lot of times we'll use like the Merlin identification app, that's through Cornell, or we might find a YouTube video that has a really great sound of it with the babies that are calling over and over again, and try to bait the parents into the spot where their baby is, because on those days, of course, the wind was pretty strong and it was a little hard to hear, even though they have better hearing than we do. The baby wasn't making as much noise as I would have typically imagined and have seen in the past. He was quiet, but you know, you could hear him. He would call back to the calls that I was playing, but it wasn't quite close enough, I think, for the parents to really hear it or approach or feel comfortable approaching. So we spent the whole next day monitoring, probably a good 6 to 8 hours back and forth. Never saw the baby truly fed by the parents. Really took until the next day when I felt much more comfortable, where in the morning, really early, I had my scope in my car and I was watching this little basket, and I was starting to get worried after about 20 minutes of being there, and then boom, lo and behold, the parents fly in. One of them actually had predated on a squirrel, and then it started coming to hang out with the baby, and he was so cute, popping his little head up over the side of the basket, and the parents were just kind of walking around. I think it was the mom that was on the side of the basket, so she's the bigger one, taking a few steps at a time, and then kind of cocking her head to the side and looking at the owlet, and then she'd preen herself, and then she'd kind of, you know, rub noses, which in this case would be their beaks together, and it was just the sweetest moment to know that it was definitely successful. The parents had found their baby, and they were caring for it, and they were showing behaviors where they were effectively hunting for it to try to support it. So all in all, just a really good reuniting case for us here with this little owlet. It is always better for babies to be brought up in the care of their own parents and not by rehabilitators, because humans are not going to be the same as owls. Any other species, it's the same way. A human will never give the right kind of care that a wild animal like an owl needs, and we're not going to give it the same kind of training and vocalizations and comfort and practice and stuff, that everything that mom naturally does for them. So for us, our plan is to try to get them back there and give them all the tools they need to survive, knowing that otherwise they would have been brought into a rehabilitator, into care, and then we would have spent months and months raising an animal that the parents would probably have done a better job if they had just had a better nest. And so that's what we offer. And it's great. It's a happy feeling knowing that we've done something good, and that hopefully those owls will come back year after year to continue nesting in that spot. And it's also just a really fun part of our jobs. It's worthwhile and it's very positive. So be on the lookout for baby owls that might be on the ground at this time of year. And then hawks will be coming up next here in the next couple of months. If you need any help or assistance, give us a call at 608-287-3235. This has been Wildlife Weekly.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Your reporter this evening was Vicki Kenyon.
Special thanks to feature contributors Pete Harden, Bert Zipper, Christine Vertico, Brian Standing, and Jackie Sandberg.
Super Dave Lawrenson engineered the show.
Faye Parks produced this newscast.
Shelley Pittman is news director at WORT, and I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News podcast and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm your host, Jess Miller. Up next is Spanish Language News with En Nuestro Patio. Good night.
Support for this program comes from WORT's listener sponsors and Hoyos Consulting, providing high-speed business internet, data center, co-location, and network consulting. Proud to have grown through referrals and proud to support the shared values of WORT Community Radio. HoyosConsulting.com.
Support for this program comes from the Konopka Lab at UW-Madison, recruiting adults 55 plus for a clinical trial, testing whether a medication can promote healthy longevity. Details are at 608-228-2978.
Support for this program is provided by WORT's listener sponsors and the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 2304. Local 2304 is a small local union with a big agenda, bringing power to the people by representing the workers who provide safe and reliable gas and electric service at MG&E. The professional union reps at Madison Teachers Incorporated and the staff collective right here at WORT. More information about the union is available on their website at IBEW2304.com.
And it's 7 o'clock. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM in Madison, Wisconsin. Coming up next, in Nuestro Patio.
Bienvenido a Nuestro Patio, un espacio en Word para la comunidad latina.
Panamá.
Presente.
Puerto Rico.
Presente. Presente.
Venezuela.
Presente.
Perú.
Presente.
República Dominicana.
Presente.
Cuba.
Presente.
Costa Rica.
Presente.
Colombia.
Presente.
Honduras.
Presente.
Ecuador.
Presente.
Bolivia.
Presente.
Argentina.
Presente.
Nicaragua sin Somoza.
Hola, hola, muy buenas tardes y bienvenidos a una edición más de Nuestro Patio, el programa en español de WORT 89.9 FM, la radio comunitaria. Hoy, martes primero de abril, ¿ya votaron? Todo el día de hoy han sido las elecciones para Corte Suprema de Wisconsin, bueno, para un asiento en la Corte Suprema de Wisconsin. Todo el día de hoy, todavía tienen oportunidad de votar. Las casillas cierran a las 8 de la noche. Si llegan y hay una fila enorme, que no creo, pero si llega a haber una fila enorme, mientras ustedes están en la fila, ustedes tendrán derecho a votar. Así que simplemente no se salgan de la silla. Digo, de la fila.